We will take up what we left off yesterday, but we will give Mr. Britton some opportunity to explain materials that you have before you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, you have a stack of really two sets of materials. The one on the top, labeled Q&A, are questions and answers really that relate to the presentations that DHS made last week with respect to the seniors and people with disabilities. And they are on top. There's an index and an attempt to show committee members who asked the questions what the information was and where the information is in this set of materials for questions and answers. The second set of materials that you have are a series of additional appendices. Looks like they begin with Appendix F. And all of this material should be put in the back of your notebooks on seniors and people with disabilities. Now, I turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Any burning statements or questions you want to ask Mr. Britton before we get into the hearing? Thank you. Ms. Page, will you and others join us as you...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services and Senior Disabilities Program, and with me is Mary Lee Fay, the Administrator of the Developmental Disabilities Office. I think we were going to start on page 47 today on performance measures, move quickly then into the budget drivers, and hope to get to the policy option packages today if we can. With that, I'll turn it over to Mary Lee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Lee Fay, seniors and people with disabilities. There are three performance measures that we'd like to review with you related to persons with developmental disabilities. The first is a measure similar to aging and people with physical disabilities, and it looks at the numbers of individuals in community settings. And as you heard from James yesterday, this is a measure that Oregon has not only excelled in nationally, but a benchmark that we've set for ourselves and continue to meet the targeted benchmarks of trying to make sure people are staying in their communities and in home settings and are part of a community setting. So this is a benchmark that has been a strong indicator for us. The next two benchmarks are benchmarks that for people with developmental disabilities that we have not met in a significant way. The first one relates to earnings, and this is the opportunity for individuals with developmental disabilities to be engaged in work where they are in jobs. Sometimes it's within a program in a sheltered setting, sometimes it's in individual community settings, but the opportunity to be able to earn incomes. And this is, we've seen a downtrend in this particular benchmark since starting in 2003. There's a couple reasons. One of them was that of 800 individuals left the comprehensive program and went into support services, and we don't collect the benchmark information for those individuals. It's something we would like to do, and we're working on trying to develop a strategy that will look at those particular wages.
So we say that one question. Does it mean that when you say that, does it mean they went more into the mainstream of the workforce?
Senator Carter, Chair Carter, they ended up having their services met through brokerages, and so they now buy their own supports. So it's a little harder to try and track because they may buy 4 hours from a program like Garten, and then they may hire a staff to help them get a job at a local restaurant. And so they mix and match their funds. And this has been a little challenging for us to try and identify how we will collect that information. But we are looking to do that. We've actually joined with 13 other states who have also seen trends in employment go down. And what we're trying to do is say, what are the key things that help people get jobs and maintain jobs? Is it training and technical assistance? Are there policy issues that we need to be addressing and doing differently? Are there different types of incentives in reimbursements for agencies to be able to do a better job of getting people jobs and helping them maintain in their jobs? So we've been working with 13 states for the last year and are starting to put together some recommendations from that group.
So actually, when we look at key performance measure number 9, say it's next session, look at 06, we might find it still flat like 04 and 05.
Our goal, Chair Carter, our goal would be that in 06 you will start to see it increase. 06, you will probably still see it flat, but we would like to maintain a benchmark that has us move up, because we believe jobs are a very important component and that we need to be doing everything we can to help get individuals into meaningful work and employment. So we would like to keep that benchmark.
Thanks. Session, Ms. Kutel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What happened in 2003 and why did so many folks go into support services?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, I'm sorry, it's a little confusing. When we started the support services program in 2001, that we separated. Yesterday I talked about our comprehensive set of systems and our support set of systems. And comprehensive would be when we're fully engaged in 24 hours. There were a group of people, about 700 to 800 people, who were living at home. So they weren't in group homes or foster care, but they were receiving some dollars so that they could go to work during the day. Those individuals, the state contracted for those services with the counties and the providers as slots. And what happened is when they got into support services, they actually took control of those budgets. They have up to $800 a month that they could spend on services. And they decided whether they indeed wanted to have their entire allocation go to working with an agency or whether they would use some of it to have a person help them and get their job. They might have gotten some other different types of services. So they actually, that group of people moved into our support services, and that's what happens in support services. People are in control of their budget. They try and prioritize what makes sense for them. It's capped. That's the kind of quid pro quo. They get to decide how to spend it, but it can't go over a certain amount. And so for those individuals, they moved out of our data system for us to collect information on and compare an apple-to-apple comparison with.
That was kind of getting to my question. So why are they not in your data system?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, because it's not an apple-to-apple comparison in terms of if they use their money and purchase a job coach to get them a job at Ross Dress for Less, we don't require Ross Dress for Less to send us information about individuals. And so their outcome and wages is what we collect.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I mean, the simplest explanation is before all those dollars were contracted with vocational providers and they provided us all the wage earning data, and now, in effect, you have individuals buying, if they're buying job supports at all, from all kinds of different places, and we've just not figured out how to put a data system together that captures that. So actually there are earnings that disappear here that are still being earned but simply don't show up because we don't have a data system that we originally put together with our provider community.
Thank you, and that makes sense to me, but this is a very important performance measure, so could we just ask them? Because even if it's like maybe not the exact number, I mean, because how do we tell if they might be having greater success in terms of their earnings via support service? We don't know. And I just
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, we have started the discussion of how could we do that, and we will pilot it or have talked about piloting it. Where can we get information from the employment department or how we cross-reference our data or get information from the brokerages? But it is an important benchmark, and it is something we are looking to get information on, but we don't have it to date. And we are not alone. Other states who are now like Oregon, having services that are self-directed where people are more in control of how their dollars are used, are trying to figure out how do we get information back on that type of spending.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Morstad?
Thank you. And if they don't have enough money in the support services, what happens?
Chair Carter, Senator Morstad, the support services are based on natural supports and state dollars, and they can't go over that amount. And so what happens is they rely still very heavily on natural supports, and by that I mean typically family supports. So families who are doing a lot of the care, a lot of the personal care, that is where the slack is taken up.
Okay. A different type of question. How do people get the 20? How do you keep track of people for care 24/7 care? I mean, how do you track people who need that kind of care?
Chair Carter, Senator Morstad, if I can clarify, if the question is, how do we know about the numbers of individuals who need that kind of care who aren't getting it?
Yeah.
Or who are in service?
Who need it.
Who need it. We right now have we look at individuals who are enrolled in case management. It tells us a very general number of individuals in terms of people who are not in any service at all. As a matter of fact, if you go to page 45 of the book, it will show you the numbers of individuals who are in comprehensive care, the number of individuals who are in support services. Those are the two services I talked about yesterday.
Yeah.
And then those who are in case management only, meaning they aren't getting any service outside of case management. To date, we have information about individuals using a case management profile, but it's not a very significant one. And when we get into budget drivers, one of the things that we have to do is end up with an assessment system that really helps us identify what are the needs of individuals and how will it relate to the cost of their support in that 24-hour service. So today, we can tell you general numbers, but we can't tell you of those numbers how many people are needing services in 6 months, in a year, will go into crisis, or not at all.
Further question?
Yeah, please. What happens if people are afraid to say they're in crisis because they don't have any choices of where their child will go? And we had testimony yesterday in another community where people were very concerned. They were in crisis. They somehow had to deal with it. They did not want to have their child put arbitrarily in Portland or Redmond or Bend and so on and so forth. And I guess it's kind of a either-or situation.
Chair Carter, Senator Morstad, I heard that testimony also, and it was around family members who were concerned that if they went into crisis, that their family member would have to leave their particular community and go to any available capacity throughout the state. And in our rules and regulations on how we manage crisis services, we do indeed say that we need to look at services and capacity where there is funding, but we also have a radius to say, if it's at a certain distance, you need to develop in the home community. So if somebody lived in Dallas, they may indeed have to move to a home in Salem if that's where the capacity was. But if the opening was in Portland or in Roseburg or in Grants Pass, we would have the county develop using our crisis service dollars for them there. So there was a little bit of a misperception of how that works. But regardless, crisis is a very harsh way into the system. And yesterday we talked about the fact that all of our development has gone into the support services, those areas where they are capped at $20,000 per year per individual, and that access to that full service has really been limited to managing the crisis, and that's how we've managed the resources that we've had, is to really say if somebody absolutely needs it, we won't turn our back on them, but it has not been a voluntary process on moving into those services.
Madam Chair, sorry, what is the name of Representative Kotek?
If Senator Kotek is going to follow up with what we discussed,
I'll let me know.
And I apologize because I should have asked this yesterday when we were talking about the Eastern Oregon Training Center, and that is we talked about the closure by 9/11, but what is the current cost per resident, and how does that compare with community-based cost? And the other question, if we look ahead in the future, when the Eastern facility is closed, how much money then becomes available for other needs in the DD community? And we're in the first and second biennium, so as we prepare to look for future, it would be helpful to have that kind of information. And if you don't have it today, Mr. Tim, if you can, get it to us later. Mm.
Chair Carter, Senator Winters, what I have today is more the per-person cost per resident, which is about $25,000 per person per month, which certainly exceeds community cost. Those individuals, if they were to move into the community, when you consider the residential care, employment, transportation, case management, other services, would be less than half. It would probably be in the neighborhood of $11,000 per month per person. The difference between once all is rolled out and completed, it's about a 50% difference. That when Fairview Training Center closed, the dollars that were associated with Fairview Training Center went to really deal with some critical infrastructure issues, which I think are still at play today. They went to a dollar an hour increase in salaries for wages, it went to family support, and it went to support some of the crisis systems in our services. So there's nothing in today's strategy that we're looking at of how we would apply those resources or what would happen to those resources if Eastern were to close. The governor's budget was not utilizing the closure of Fairview to put those dollars into developmental disability services when it was originally put in our budget.
So the agreement that we had when we closed Fairview, for example, when we sold the land and we did things, the agreement was then that would go back into services for the DD population, and that the interest earnings and what have you would go in to serve that population.
Chair Carter, Senator Winters, that was an important feature of the closure of Fairview Training Center. It was 30% of our budget for about 3% of the population at the time it closed. And so as the community infrastructure was struggling, those dollars were looked at to stabilize as well as support those individuals who at the time lived at Fairview to move into the community and be supported well. It was first and foremost taking care and making sure those individuals had opportunities to be in placement, but then looked at the overall infrastructure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still struggling to get a sense of the need. I'm familiar with other programs, I think, better. Do you have waiting lists in your programs? Waiting lists? How do you try? Because I'm just wondering. I'm trying to, because I would guess, I look at the numbers and I'm thinking, there are probably more folks who need the services, and how do you track that? And
Chair Carter and Senator Kotek, if you move on to page 50,
I'm happy to be a senator.
On some of the drivers, the issues of caseload, demographics, and wait list are certainly an issue and a concern. Going back to the year 2000 when we settled the lawsuit which developed support services, as James mentioned yesterday, it was another watershed period for us in terms of change in systems. At the time that was settled, there was a very long wait list, and it was the public policy that said if you wait long enough, when we have a vacancy, you'll get access to those services. But truly, the development in the 90s was helping people who were in our services in Fairview move into the community, and very little was done to meet the needs of the community wait list. And so those waiting lists were 10, 15, 20 years, really not
reasonable at all, and hence the settlement and the lawsuit and the settlement. But it also was meant that a number of people never had a reason to enroll in case management. So as we began developing support services, we tried to anticipate the numbers of people who would be needing services. And we've already gone past what we thought that would be. We thought we would be at about 5,000 people, and that would be the bulk of catching up to the wait list, and then it would be people as needed. But in this next biennium, this daily settlement rollout continues with another 1,400 people who are still waiting to get into that service alone. So we know that that's increased. In case management this last year, the last fiscal year, there were 1,350 people who were enrolled into case management. 67% of those were children. So we're seeing in our caseload a growth that's happening, and those individuals will be eligible for STALE. But there are still many people who will be wanting more 24-hour service. And so those are numbers that we don't yet know of that group, how we will anticipate who will go into and want something beyond that, because to date it's still a crisis-driven scenario. In this last biennium, our crisis service doubled, meaning the numbers of people who went into crisis and needed something beyond what they had. And crisis to us means that either they have to leave because their family can no longer support them, or it could be because the agency or where they're currently living can't support them. And we've seen both agencies struggling because of not being able to maintain staff. The turnover that they see really puts that system into crisis. I think 54% of our crisis came from people who are already in our service. So that was a significant concern, plus a high number of individuals who are coming into the service from the family home. So we used to anticipate about 18 people a month, children and adults, and it's now grown to nearly 40 people a month new coming in for crisis services.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Which leads me to another question I mean to ask is respite care, not only for the DD population, but the entire population that you serve that might need it. I think we had lifespan respite was under SPD. Is that, are we going to talk about that during your presentation? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we certainly could. I don't think we had planned to, but we certainly could. And we've been working with the stakeholders to that program took some severe reductions, both in loss of federal match and loss of positions associated with it. And we've had discussions with the stakeholders, and I think Dr. Goldberg has agreed to try to revitalize that program and put some more money back into it and staff it up. But it has languished in the last couple of years.
I would like an update. We'll need to do it now, okay. Or you can provide it in writing.
We can do that, certainly.
Representative Knight. Okay. Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I came in a few minutes late. What I heard was your caseloads are going up at a rate you didn't really expect. Is that the result of a change in how you're doing diagnoses? Are we talking about autism or Asperger's, or is it some other issue here? Is something changing in our population? And if so, you know what's driving it.
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, I think the answer is yes to all of those things. I think we are seeing an increase in diagnoses that we haven't seen, increase 20% of the people coming new into case management were people with autism. So we are seeing an increase in requests of that. We're seeing an increase in individuals with fetal alcohol and other drug-affected issues as children. So the changes there are coming. The people who are coming into our full services for crisis are also coming in with co-occurring issues of mental health, co-occurring issues related to some criminal justice as well. 30% of the people in crisis this last year also had mental health, which is very high. That's a high figure for us. So we're seeing the intensity of needs that people who would try and manage without services are now coming into our service system, which is taxing it. And then certainly seeing just a new group of individuals that and autism, it's hard to tell if that increase is because we're better at diagnosing. I think we are better at diagnosing, but I think it's beyond just diagnosing. I think there is a truly an increase in seeing the individuals who are diagnosed with the autism spectrum disorder.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Proceed. Let me, and I apologize to be jumping a little bit with you, but I'd like to go back to one last performance measure, and it's on individuals who experience a re-abuse. And it's back on page 49, and on your handouts, if you look at I, there's a little bit of detail in there. Again, this is an increase rather than a decrease, and it's and we believe the benchmark should be where it's at. So we're seeing a higher number of individuals who experience an abuse for a second time, meaning that there will be a second abuse within the year that the abuse occurred. And we do track these, and we look at this information on a monthly basis in our office, and also look to try and figure out, is there training or things that we could look at? When, if you go to section I, it breaks down a little bit what's happened, and I think you'll find that the type of abuse where that is the most dominant is around the area of neglect. And for us, neglect can mean everything. It doesn't mean that the person actually was harmed, but that they were at risk of harm. So neglect could mean that there was a medication error. Neglect could mean that staff fell asleep on the job. Neglect could mean that someone didn't follow through on a plan or a protocol that could have resulted in the person having injury or harm. To us, what that says is if you're an agency dealing with a lot of turnover and a lot of new staff and a lot of staff training, it's starting to impact the quality of care and the safety of the individuals we support. So we are concerned with seeing this number increase. We'll be looking at issues around training, but we also know that some of it's going to be dependent on the structure and the infrastructure of the agencies that we work with. So it's a concern benchmark for us.
It's well to have the percentages, but it would be helpful for me if we had the raw number.
If you go to the second page behind there, I believe you'll have the numbers for calendar year 2005 and on the back of that 2004. So it will give you the breakdown of how many, and what you look at there is how many reports there were. So not abuse means that we investigated and there was no abuse. The numbers that were substantiated as abused, and then the number of re-abuse. So out of that 404 abused, there were 457 individuals who experienced a second abuse within that year.
Further questions, anyone?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Let me move on to some of the key budget and drivers, some of which we've talked about, and then we'll go into our policy option packages.
One of the performance measures that I apologize also for being here late, and so if you've already covered this, let me know. But there's one that has average earnings for SPD clients. Did you discuss that one?
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, yes, we did, and we did note that it's an important feature. We've seen it go down based on some changes in data, but also we're looking to do some different trainings and policy directions that would bring that back up.
If I might, Madam Chair, this is from people that are working in sheltered workshops and this kind of thing. What would be a scenario where they would be employed? And I'm just curious about what kind of work this is.
If you go to Appendix H, you'll see that it's broken down. What we've done is track the numbers of individuals since 3. This is the data that we collect. And it will show you the numbers of individuals who were receiving earnings in these categories. Sheltered employment, which would be your workshops. Many of them have some of the contracts for the products of the disabled law. Group employment, that could be individuals who are having
do a landscaping type of program. Individual jobs means that the person is working in a job in the community, typically one person at a time with some support. Self-employment was very small. Those are a few individuals who have run their own coffee shops or coffee carts or things like that.
And so can you help me understand, do they actually get to keep these wages? How does that part of it work?
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, they keep wages except if for the individuals who are in our 24-hour Medicaid programs, there is an offset, meaning it's a Medicaid law that says individuals, any individuals, not just developmental disabilities, have to contribute to care if they can. And so there's a certain amount of money that is set aside that says you can earn up to a certain amount, at which point the earnings are offset for the cost of your care.
What is the point that the offset begins? I'm curious about how much they actually get to keep out of this.
I'm going to ask you that. They keep, Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, they keep $65 of their earnings.
And does this, are most of these people on Medicaid, or are most of them in programs?
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, unlike our seniors in program where you have a combination of individuals who are private pay, many people paying, and some on Medicaid, for persons with developmental disabilities, 99% are individuals on Medicaid. Medicaid is first considered because of their income, because they're individuals who don't have income. And so almost all of our services are use the Medicaid programs and use a significant amount of federal dollars to help support what we do in the state. 60% of it is federal.
So then no matter how many hours these people work, they end up getting just a small percentage of it.
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, we're hoping that the PREMU program, the Employed Persons with Disabilities Act, which was something that was enacted federally, which allows people to maintain more or keep more of their income and not lose Medicaid benefits, would be a program that we could expand and look at. There are only, how many people do you remember? There are only 82 people currently in the program with developmental disabilities. So it is a program that we need to look at and expand more.
How much does the agency realize from this revenue source?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I think, I don't know that we have it broken out by DD, but in terms of client offsets, it is it's a large other fund. Does anybody shuttle work? Do you know off the top of your head? We can certainly get you that number.
I would be very curious about how this is accounted for inside the agency and what percentage of funding it is. And I think, Madam Chair, the point here is that it seems that a huge part of the goal of this is to have these people be as self-sufficient as possible. And if they are working, gainfully employed, but they don't realize any benefit from doing that, that money just doesn't, they don't have any control over it, it isn't part of how they see themselves or part of the way they personally perceive themselves, that it's kind of working at odds with the purpose of the program, and that to move us in a direction where they did control the amount of money that they made, I mean, it's a pittance, it's a very, very small amount of money, but to take it back again and deprive them of the benefits of the money that they earn, I think is counterproductive.
Have you always done it this way?
Again, Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, it is federal law that if you're between 100% and 300% of SSI, 300% of SSI, which is about $1,700 plus a month, and 100% is about close to $700 for a single individual, but between those two, you have to contribute, again, towards the cost of your care with only a nominal disregard if you have earnings on top of that. The developmental disabilities community, and we totally agree with that, has been very troubled by that for many years and actually has tried to bring in legislation that would allow us to waive larger percentages of that income and actually seek a waiver from the federal government to do that. Our difficulty has been such a waiver would really, to be fair, would have to encompass our entire population, and we're not sure the federal government, based on our conversations, would grant that. So what we're looking at is we do have the Employed Persons with Disabilities Act that actually allows you to buy into the Medicaid program and to set up other special accounts that have employment-related type expenses where you can, in effect, shelter that from a client offset. And I think we have a lot more people with physical disabilities that are taking advantage of that. We have not really expanded that program significantly for people with developmental disabilities, and I think that's the issue at hand now, is can we really make a better fit with what's called EPD, the Employed Persons with Disabilities, to expand that, particularly to the higher earners of people with developmental disabilities. But we can provide you a lot of data in terms of client offsets, how they're collected, what portion of our budget that actually sustains.
If I might, Madam Chair, so can you talk to us a little bit about what the agency intends to do with the DD population in this area? Where are you going to move with relevance to this issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Moore, I don't think Mary Lee or I are either the experts on the Employed Persons with Disabilities Act, but so we could bring that information forward to say exactly how we think that program can be expanded to shelter more income from earnings of this population.
Thank you. I would appreciate getting that information.
Okay, we'll certainly do that.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And this will come sort of a statement and also a question. In my other life, I have the opportunity, honor, and pleasure of having some of these people in my practice, and they're really wonderful individuals. Most of them are very gentle souls. They're very excited about being able to go to work every day. But they also are a little bit vulnerable sometimes. And I think some of the thinking behind sheltering some of this money was to be careful that others in our society who might take advantage of them aren't allowed to do that. And so as you go through looking at this carefully and trying to make a decision about maybe changing some of these policies, please be cautious. These are wonderful people. But they have difficulty sometimes with making good decisions and are susceptible to people in our society who take advantage of them. On the other hand, it's great to have them out in our world with us, working with us, and no longer locked up behind walls. So just a word of caution, if we could. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just have a question right here. And that is the reason for the decline. We went from 1465 in 03 and 1170 in 06, and why the drop in the sheltered employment. And if I look across the spectrum in all categories, we've gone from 3,414 down to 3,028. What are the causes of the drivers that's causing that to be reduced?
Chair Carter, Senator Winder, some of that is just based on, as I was describing earlier, individuals that aren't counted in this are individuals who are buying their own supports, the support services. So as we've seen that go up, that now 4,500 people in that particular setting, 800 of them came from programs that used to be contracted in this service. So that is some of the issues.
Thank you.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, continuing on with a couple of the drivers that are facing us. Yesterday, James talked about some of the cracks we're starting to see in our system. And I think as I referenced a caseload growing and an intensity of the supports that is challenging both the case management system and the provider system, that's the first places we're seeing areas of the infrastructure being challenged. Counties have very high caseloads at the moment, and the local admin and local administrative costs are low. It's about 1.9% of overall program budgets is what they use for local administration. And counties themselves are starting to think about where their role should be in actually doing the services. Counties are the ones who are responsible for determining the eligibility for developmental disabilities, for enrolling individuals in programs, putting plans of care together, looking for and developing providers, both foster care providers and community providers. They do the protective services, they do the assessments, and as you can see from that list that goes on and on, there is a huge amount of responsibility. And in the last several years, there's been increasing outcome measures that have been that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services are expecting of us. So their activities have really gotten more intense, the workload has gotten more challenging, and the models for funding them have not changed. In this last biennium, we actually had two counties, now three counties, who are no longer doing the services at all, and we had to do a request for proposal and have a private provider, private nonprofit provider, that's in the Coos Bay, Josephine, and Harney counties. So we're seeing pieces of the system starting to be challenged on how to continue serving individuals, and that concerns us. Also, the infrastructure of our providers. This is the first biennium where that a cost of living has been provided, and even then it was not for a full biennium, and there had been 5 years prior to that where there was no cost of living. And as you can imagine, not only in the wages, but things from health care benefits, et cetera, that have increased, that has been challenged. And we see the results of that, of agencies not being able or not willing to develop for new individuals. We talked about folks coming into crisis, people who really have intense needs, and if agencies are trying to maintain their infrastructure for the people they currently see, there are fewer and fewer who are willing to expand. That's a concern to us.
Okay. Can we call Representative Corrott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. With so much emphasis on the county in this process, I'm wondering what concerns you could share with us in regards to the possibility of the federal timber payments being withdrawn from the counties. And I'm already hearing rumors that several counties are ready to give programs back to the state. So I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Madam Chair and Representative Girard, I don't have it with us, but we've been collecting a lot of information from the counties exactly where they're at and how precipitous that drop has been, and which are actually considering potentially giving up. Could be public health, could be mental health, or could be a developmental disabilities program, or the whole thing. So we're tracking that, and we can certainly bring that forward, and we've had considerable discussions with our local government advisory committee as well. I mean, we're still kind of hoping and praying that the federal government may extend the grace period on this, but we're very concerned that that will sort of knock the floor out from many of our local partners. But we can bring forward actually what we're tracking in that regard.
Madam Chair. To Representative Gordon.
Thank you very much. Not on the same subject, but in the area of caseload and demographics. Could you talk about the increase in the number of individuals experiencing crisis who also have mental health challenges? Could you talk about it in terms of whether this is something new? What's the impact, the overall impact on the system, and how is the system responding to the issue?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, I don't think that it is new in the system that people with developmental disabilities also experience mental health issues. I think what is new for us in the increase is that the community resources are challenged to the point where we are struggling to find the right amount of resources that both deals with the mental health component as well as with the developmental disabilities issue. In the last 3 months, Bob Nickel from Mental Health Services and I have formed an internal committee to look at areas where we overlap. Individuals who have developmental disabilities or other low cognitive issues who also have mental health, and where are the areas that we could be learning from each other. I think there is a number of training opportunities and trainings that we can learn in developmental disabilities community. We're used to supporting people in figuring out how to learn skills and how to get into the community and be part of the community. I'm not so sure we've been very effective at treatment strategies around mental health issues. And I think conversely, mental health could benefit from some of the things we've learned and what it takes to support someone to just kind of manage day-to-day life skills. So we're hoping that we can learn from each other. So the increase has had an impact in that the resources have been challenging to get access to. Service providers have not been as prepared as they could be, and therefore the person ends up moving. I think I talked a little bit about when we use the state-operated community program as a safety net. Many of the individuals there are folks who have not been stable with some of their mental health issues and end up in the most expensive services we have in the community. So we are experiencing that and know that we have to deal with it differently.
Mm-hmm. So if I may follow up, Madam Chair.
Please do.
There's a challenge to get access to services, and then there are cases when people, in order to get access, have to move. Move to what exactly? Can you provide an example?
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, an example of somebody who was in a group home in Roseburg and through a number of psychiatric, not being able to be maintained psychiatrically, by the time that may have manifested in some aggressive behaviors, and the provider says they can no longer support the person. And in order to find a placement stable enough, meaning that the person's moving to Eugene or they may be moving to Salem or Portland. So the individual one has had to move out of their community, has had to move, period, which is pretty traumatic, and a new group of people need to get to know that person and understand them. So I think not having the supports in place plays out in that people end up having to move and end up with new sets of treatment providers as well as new staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Back to the county payments issue, I'm wondering what the issues are around maintenance of effort if the county's back out. Are there issues around the county's investments in the program, which are often buildings and different things like that, going to have an impact on maintenance of effort, or are they not large enough investments?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I think in each case to date, correct me if I'm wrong, Mary Lee, where a county has actually had to leave the program and we've had to take it over or contract it out to some other kind of entity, we've done it within the original budget that was available to the county. We've been very challenged in doing that. Some of the difficulty we have is under current law, particularly if you have public employees, during the transition period of at least a year, you have to honor their salaries and benefits. And in many cases, counties pay higher salaries and benefits than the state may. It depends. It varies all over the map. And so we could have increased costs there that on a transition period. I think a lot of that workload gets absorbed in terms of, all the budgeting, accounting, and other kinds of functions that the county typically does simply devolve back to the department. So whether we've really done sort of a true cost analysis there, I don't think so. But it's very hard for us to absorb that workload.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair Carter, let me mention one more thing on the budget driver that I don't think I've already touched in some manner or another, and that's on our rate setting and assessments. And if you turn to our very last handout, I think it's K in your attachments, there is just a one-page descriptor of a program that we've engaged in. We received a federal grant from Centers on Medicare and Medicaid to have us look at retooling an assessment and a rate structure. We, in our provider system, live on what we call a legacy system. It means that if a group home got started in 1991 with a certain rate, that's the rate they're still at. And we may have done development in 1998 and 2000 and 2003. And as we did it, we would learn and we would apply models that we were legislatively approved to, but we never went back and corrected or amended or looked at individual needs. And so our provider system is out there living with a very different set of rates, supporting many of the same individuals. And this is something we saw CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, direct us to take a look at in other states as well, of saying, how are you getting at individual assessments, and how are you determining the rate of cost? And so we applied for and got a grant to put it all together. We're in the process of doing a new assessment tool that we would propose once we roll it out to do every so often, every several years, and it collects information about the individual, and then it will translate into what a rate will be. So it's much more across the board. It's the same tool that's used statewide, and that we don't have to wait for someone to go into crisis, that we have the opportunity using this tool to reapply it every so often in years, so that as the need has changed, we can capture it there and not wait for it to get extraordinary and most costly. So it's a big project for us. It will have us reconceptualizing our comprehensive services. It's a very important process, and it's taking a lot of time, meaning a couple of years, before we'll be able to actually roll it out. We have, like most of our policy work, we do it with our partners. We have providers and families and self-advocates and county staff at the table with us, who are really looking very closely, and I think people are very excited that we could have a tool to use. But it's an important tool for us, and we think that we will have better information from a pilot a year from now to try and identify what will be the implications of a tool like that. So those are our budget drivers. I think yesterday we've already talked about Eastern and Oregon Training Center and the state-operated programs, so I think we should move into the policy option pack.
Are there further questions before we go to the next issue?
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, proceed. People on the wait list for services, where are they demographically? I mean, do you have, are they in some, the amounts in Salem, in Jackson County, but where are they?
Senator Winters, people on a wait list are in every one of our communities. When we rolled out the support services, we did it statewide, and we had each county try and identify numbers of individuals. In the packet that you got, appendix, it's this daily... Appendix G. That refers to every year we have to put together a report for the plaintiffs on how we're doing and implementing it. And there's a section in there, on where people, on how we're getting individuals off the wait list and the order of which they're coming off the wait list.
But while she looks for it, let me take a stab at this again, Madam Chair, Senator Winters. The wait list is a bit confusing because, again, in 2001, when we settled a Staley lawsuit, we said we are strategically going to contain very tightly the growth of 24-hour care and try to push out new development and new dollars over a 6 to 8 year period to get everybody who is DD eligible some level of service, primarily in the support area, which is non-24-hour care. Until that time, we have thousands of people on waiting lists, often for 24-hour care, who believed, well, I have to get my son or daughter on the waiting list because it will probably be 10 or 12 or 15 years before they ever get service. And again, we redirected that and said our goal here is to get everybody some service, even for those still living at home with their families, so their families are better off, the individual is better off, until such time where the person clearly can't stay at home. The big issue now, once we finish this enrollment, which we will by the end of this next biennium, the next big issue facing this field will be the pent-up demand for 24-hour care. We've got lots of people with developmental disabilities living with their aging caregivers, and even younger families who really want more independence and community living options for their sons and daughters, which they certainly deserve. But again, and Mary Lee described it almost as a bit harsh, but we absolutely contain the growth of one part of the service system, expanded those services based on the Staley lawsuit agreement, and we're going to have to play catch-up and deal with that pent-up demand now. The interesting thing that we've also found is a waiting list for 24-hour care, often because families felt they had to get their sons and daughters on the list, but even in cases where we've said there is an opening now, often even older parents will say, well, I'm just not ready right now, we're doing okay, but probably a year or two from now. So even a residential waiting list can't tell you precisely when that individual and family will actually choose the date that they want to enter a 24-hour kinds of support program. But again, it was a strategic choice to expand non-24-hour care.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's helpful. But if you have any kind of data, even though they may not be ready, it would be helpful for us to have what it is and where they are. You know, all of us represent different areas of the state, and I think that's a very useful piece of information.
Chair Carter, Senator Winters, I can get that data for you, and I'd break it into two things. One, for those individuals who are just in case management only by county, so you'll know they're not in any service. And then those are in our support services by county, which may mean they're getting something but could indeed want to move into something more. We'll get
that. Would be helpful. Thank you.
Chair Marsha?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there different levels of 24-hour care? Is there a least expensive, most expensive type of 24-hour?
Chair Carter, Senator Moore said yes. The 24-hour care is really takes a look at individual needs and the amount of staff. It's almost always staffing driven, which will tell us. If somebody can be in a home and is pretty able to assist themselves and they could have one staff and five individuals, that's going to be your least expensive home, versus we have some individuals who need some one-on-one skills or individuals for transfer needs where you have to have two staff in the house.
Madam Chair, thank you. That's part of the information.
Okay.
How do we gear toward that? I mean, where's the greatest need? Is the greatest need for the people who just need some minimum 24-hour care, or is the greatest need for those people who are totally dependent on having someone there?
Chair Carter, Senator Morissette, I think we find that really where people end up in 24-hour need is often as much to do with circumstances as it does with needs. I think we have individuals in our support services living with family with great need, a lot of care need, and individuals like them in our group homes as well. So it's often a matter of circumstances, which makes it a challenge to identify how to determine who comes next.
I'm sorry, one more time. I'm talking about the 24-hour care that is outside the home.
Okay.
So if we're going to build a facility, do we build, are we more likely to build them for the people who are there more people with lesser needs, or are there more people with greater needs for outside the home?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I mean, actually Mary Lee was trying to state how this works, and it is correct that the entrance into 24-hour care is less a function of the person's level of disability than it is the support structure they have and whether or not the family still has the resources to support that person. So you could have a person with mild retardation or moderate retardation that doesn't have real extensive needs, but the family can no longer, for whatever reason, maintain them, and they'll have priority coming into our 24-hour system than someone who's profoundly retarded, multiply disabled, bedridden, etc., but still has the family resources to support them. So, again, it's not really complexity of need. It's the circumstance which triggers that entrance into 24-hour care. And quite frankly, it's pretty much the same in our senior and physical disability system, too, where often the precipitating event into full-time care is because of what else is happening in the family. And once they get into our 24-hour system, then we have a whole range of options and rates that is tied more to their actual complexity of need, although, as Mary Lee said, our rate structure is way out of kilter and needs to be recalibrated to be more sensitive to those needs. But, again, the triggering event is usually a family event, not an individual disability circumstance.
Thank you. Representative Corchette?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we haven't got onto the policy option packages yet, but on page 53, you make reference to what was the proposed reduction for the Eastern Oregon Training Center, and I know it's no longer there, but could, and I think you brought it up briefly the other day, but what's the timeline? It says here that folks have gotten together, have agreed to continue operations. What's the specific plan for looking at this? Who's going to be involved? In terms of potentially phasing out that facility for this population?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, two things. One, the governor did, in liaison with the Pendleton community, we have identified members of that community, including the local legislators, city mayor, other city manager, other interested individuals that have been part of a group that we have been talking with in terms of future uses for the facility. In the meantime, we internally to the department are looking at every potential option across all of our populations, which may or may not be a fit for that facility. It includes mental health and other areas as well. And we're still working on that now and haven't determined whether that's going to work or not. I think our timeline is before the year is up to have a clear plan in place. And if we do, then we'll bring forward a proposal to change or close or modify in the next budget cycle. We believe we'll have something in place that for the next budget cycle, the phase out of the developmental disability portion of the program will occur in the 09-11 biennium. But beyond that, we have not put an absolute hard date on that at this point.
Representative Wilkinson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did hear about this the other day, and we asked some questions and got some information. I just want to make it very clear from the answer today that we're not talking about determining that there is a population or a group of persons who does not need supports. It has to do with transitioning a facility to other uses, but those persons would still be served, but through some other mechanism or some other service that does exist and for which there is some capacity. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson. Just like when we phased out Fairview, everybody that left with a 24-hour package that included residential care, transportation, case management, day or vocational services. It was an all-encompassing envelope of service that either was available in existing capacity or we developed new. For example, when we phased out Fairview, we literally built some 200 new homes and staffed them across the entire state. So I believe it would be a combination, the transition would be a combination of what's existing capacity and then what new development would we have to do for the individuals before they can relocate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That satisfies the question.
Thank you. For the question, before we move on, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, if we could move on to the policy option packages, of which there are two key packages in the developmental disabilities area. The first policy option package has to do with the Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board. This is a little bit of a complicated issue. I want to take just a few minutes talk about this because it has been an issue of some debate both last session and this session. Last session, the Oregon Law Commission brought forward a proposal to include both youth with mental illness and youth with developmental disabilities into the statute having to do with PSRB. Until that time, the PSRB really covered adults, although it was sort of silent on the role of youth. But the problem was for youth who might invoke a defense that said, I'm not guilty because of reason of my mental illness or developmental disability, there was no dispositional path. They would end up going into a youth correctional setting like any other youth that didn't invoke that defense. So the intent of legislation from last session and brought forward again this session was to give a clear dispositional path for youth that committed a serious, not a Measure 11 offense, but still a serious person-to-person assault type of crime, that if they invoke that defense and the juvenile court found them as successfully having invoked that defense, they would then be committed to the Department of Human Services, not the Oregon Youth Authority. And the Department of Human Services then would be responsible for both their care, their treatment, and the security needs that such a child might present. In the last biennium, we phased in children with mental illness. That's just beginning now. The Mental Health Office brought forward budget proposals for that group. Senate Bill 328 has passed the Senate, I believe, and is probably either here or on its way here. It would now also include children with developmental disabilities. We have no exact way of knowing the number of children that might be involved. We know right now we serve about 37 youth with developmental disabilities that committed crimes of the type for which that type of defense could be invoked, not saying they would or that their lawyers or the DAs would agree to that, but just as a marker in terms of sort of the universe there. And we know of that group of 37 children, 22 of those children committed those offenses within the last 18 months. The big issue for us on the Department of Human Service side is in the developmental disabilities area, we don't lock up any kids. We have no capacity in our system to incarcerate anyone. Many, many years ago, we had a locked cottage at Fairview. We unlocked that even years before Fairview closed. For the 37 youth that I just described that are currently served in our system, we have some very expensive, highly monitored, highly staffed programs. We have group homes with alarms on all the doors and windows and staff that go out the door and chase kids down if they actually attempt to elope. Have some kids that have committed some pretty serious offenses that when they're in the community, we have to shadow them within sight and keep very close tabs on them because of their dangerous behaviors. But we don't actually incarcerate or lock children up. Our interpretation of the statutory requirement under this is the court could order a child to actually be in a locked facility, and the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the new juvenile panel that's been created, likewise could develop rules or criteria that would require us to actually incarcerate or lock up children. So this particular budget capacity package creates the capacity initially for 10 children that would be phased in over the course of the biennium. We're already negotiating with Albertina Kerr for a particular portion of their campus that we, out of this $2 million package, we would secure that building. We would then pay the cost in the neighborhood of $500 to $600 a day is about what the price tag would be for this, for the treatment and care for these kids for that period of time. Beyond that, again, we don't know if that's the right number. This is simply a prediction based on the kinds of kids we know now. It's been an area of concern for us because this is a new mandate. The courts and the PSRB control both the front door and the back door. We don't. So this is a mandated caseload and a very expensive caseload that ends up being included now in the long-term care portion of the department. We're working with the juvenile panel of PSRB. We've included amendments in Senate Bill 328 that really directs both the department and the juvenile panel to work very closely together to really look at criteria that will limit in every way possible the number of children that actually have to be locked up, and that hopefully we can address both their security and their care needs in every way possible. And the key issue here is Medicaid and the federal government. The Medicaid program on the developmental disability side will not pay match for kids that are incarcerated. We've actually researched what every other state does. Every other state has tried to figure out a Medicaid program that will fit for the DD population, even when the doors are locked, and we've come up short. And the few states that have tried it, the federal government has come in and jerked the federal funds back out. So at this point, the reason we've paid so much attention to this policy area is any kid that ended up being incarcerated would be general fund only at a pretty high price tag.
What is the age range, again, that we're talking about here?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe that the juvenile PSRB jurisdiction goes to age 21.
And the low end age is what?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't think there is a low end age.
No, but it's mainly in the early to mid-teens.
Yeah, most of the kids are 13, 14, 15, and that's typically the age of when these children come to us.
So is that defined in the statute that established the PSRB, the age range? No limit.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, again, I don't think there's a bottom limit. I think it simply refers to children under the age of 21. I will double check that, but that's what I believe it.
How many other states, we're still needing to define the criteria that would possibly lead to a child or children being locked up. How many other states lock up children?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think most do, but in almost all cases it's within their youth correctional setting. Oregon is unique in having a psychiatric review process, and that's one of the hallmarks of the way we operate here. So other states, for the most part, lock those kids up in youth correctional facilities, as has happened. We have a group of children with developmental disabilities at McLaren presently.
Okay, so we'll be the first state to use the PSRB as a step toward locking up children. That's
correct. On the treatment and care side, on the human service side, correct. To our knowledge, yes, that is the case.
And can you tell me why did we decide as a state to this methodology?
Madam Chair, the Oregon Law Commission and the Juvenile Code Subcommittee of the Oregon Law Commission studied this for a long time and felt pretty strongly that, again, the defense was always available, so a child could invoke that defense, but they felt pretty strongly there was a constitutional right to treatment. But if you invoke the defense successfully and the outcome was simply being popped into a correctional setting like anybody else who didn't invoke the defense, that in fact you were avoiding a constitutional right to treatment. So that really was the burning issue that sort of brought this forward, and the reason that these kids are now proposed for inclusion in this statute.
So in your, I don't want to put you in an awkward situation, were there other alternatives that other states are using that when kids need to be separated in society that they would find a way other than locking them up?
Madam Chair, we explored, and I don't know if we could have gotten there at some point, we explored whether there was a different route that would have happened on the civil commitment side. A lot of states civilly commit, not because of a crime per se, but individuals with serious behaviors who really can't live more freely in the community. And in the old days at Fairview, we had many individuals that had committed crimes, never been adjudicated, and people would just go straight through the civil commitment statute, commit them to our care, but they didn't come in through the criminal justice door. So I think in other states where some of the kids are in youth correctional settings alongside of non-disabled populations, many of those states also have some civil commitment capacity, although more and more rarely for children. Very few states are still civilly committing children. Some are. But again, when we surveyed, we went to every listserv, we interviewed lots of different states. No one seemed to have a clear path here. And again, Oregon was doing something unique, so it didn't really provide us with a lot of experience that we could use for both budgeting and planning purposes.
Madam Chair,
so what
if I may follow up? Unique doesn't necessarily translate as progressive, and I'm still struggling, frankly. This is now law, I understand that, but I'm still struggling with what we've done. What reservations do you have about implementing the juvenile PSRB?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we have no reservations about including children with developmental disabilities in the juvenile PSRB statute. That's not the issue for us. I think the heart of the matter for us is to what degree we will actually have to end up incarcerating children and what the criteria will be for that. Because, quite frankly, if members of the public, and I suspect if some of you looked at some of the kids we serve in these programs and their behavioral or criminal profiles, you would also be concerned about supporting these kids in an unlocked setting, because some of them have committed pretty serious offenses. I think we have done an incredible job in securing those sites, in staffing them. They end up being very expensive. They are under the Medicaid program because they're not locked. So I think we believe if we can continue, for the most part, to support these kids under the PSRB statute as we have had been supporting them without the PSRB statute, I think we have both the capacity, we have a provider system, and we've budgeted in the past for these kids. So the reservation we have is the degree to which kids will be locked up, and I think that's the burning issue, and that's why we wanted to make sure in the statutory formulation that there was sort of a joint direction to both PSRB, which holds the keys to the front and the back door, and to the department to work together on those criteria. Because, again, the budget issues, and this will be a mandated budget, we'll have no control over that as these kids come to the front door, and we can't actually control the release date. So I think that's the area that we're concerned about, and that hopefully we will resolve together with PSRB.
Mm-hmm. Somebody yesterday we talked about the state operated group homes, and I believe I requested a profile of the individuals in the homes. How do they differ from the PSRB population that we're talking about? Or do they?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I think over half of the population in state operated have significant behavioral needs. Those with actual criminal behaviors, I'm not sure what that percentage would be, but as you'll recall in the big debate over the closure of Fairview, there were some folks left that had committed arson, sexual offenses, and things of that sort that were very high profile that we actually placed in our state-operated program. Again, not locked, but pretty secure in almost every way, and we've not had major incidences of reoccurrences of crime or danger to the public.
I think I share the heartburn that we're feeling up here on this panel. About the lockup aspect, and I really encourage PSRB, and you don't have very close. I think this absolute well spent sitting up here, and knowing that, you know, state-op group homes did have, and they probably still do right now, some individuals with some criminal behavior, and that we have been successful in maintaining them without threat of harm to the community.
So, your pleasure. It's 2:25. You want to let me start on a new point, or you want to complete something? What do you think, Ms. Ferry?
Madam Chair, if we can just talk very quickly about the last policy option package.
Oh, good. Okay.
Since it deals with rates, and during my testimony the last 2 days, I think I laid out the issues that are facing our community provider system. What we tried to do in this package was saying of the issues that really stress our provider agency, one of them is around keeping and maintaining staff. We know that there's about a 65% turnover, but more concerning than that, I think the figures we get, and I think you'll hear from providers, is that 7 out of every 10 staff turnover. So there's a group that might stay, but of the group that leaves, it's quick and revolving, and we're seeing the impact in the quality of care. So what this package tried to address was issues related to keeping and maintaining staff. We don't have data on numbers of FTE, so we're careful to say we can't do something that equals just $1 an hour, but we use that as a benchmark to say if we could increase direct care provider wages, increase some of the payroll expenses that would include health care benefits, what kind of percentage increase would that bring to our providers? And this particular package of $12 million general fund would allow us to have about a 14% increase in our residential provider and about a 10% increase in our vocational employment type of programs, and the difference between the two is the staff intensity. There's many more staff in a 24/7 type of program. It doesn't start until October of 08, but it is critical, what we believe is a critical component to what we need to do to make sure that that capacity is out there. We're very fortunate that many of our providers are nonprofits and through the years have been able to try and use some of their own creativity to fill in gaps, but that has gone farther and farther away as we've seen minimum wage increase and the provider, what they're able to present as wages decrease and that gap narrows. They are having a harder and harder time both attracting the staff and maintaining the staff to do work that is very involved and very intense. So this particular policy option package is a critical component of what we believe we need to do.
Thank you. Questions? Discussion? Representative Nicholson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to mention something that is pertinent here, but also for several other policy option packages where there's a proposal to increase provider rates. When I think about the people doing these hard jobs and in some cases haven't gotten a pay raise for some years, I think it's not only a question of doing the right thing, but one thing that's a little puzzling to me is because of the way information is structured for us as part of a Ways and Means Subcommittee, we see the cost. Here it's a cost of $12 million to the general fund. But this is not what I would call a net cost. This is a cost to the general fund, but this kind of cost yields many benefits. It brings federal dollars to the state in many cases. Those federal dollars have a return on investment, a multiplier effect of several times because that's additional money coming to Oregon. Not only is that additional money, but some of the people who are performing these hard jobs for us may need public assistance themselves because of the nature of the low wage and what it costs them to maintain their own family. So there may be avoided costs that we would see in this biennium, that even right away, for less demand on public service. But given the multiplier effect, the avoided costs that we may have in other areas, I'm kind of saddened to see that the only information we get is a $12 million general fund cost, but once you subtract the other benefits, tangible benefits that accrue, the actual cost to the state, to the general fund, is probably something quite a bit less than that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
A question about the co-chair's budget. Part of this top is in the co-chair's. I'm wondering if it includes the last line item there that talks about additional funding to adjust to moving to an individualized rate assessment tool for residential and day programs. Is that
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, that piece, I mentioned that assessment tool that we're doing, there's $150,000 in this $12 million that is included to do that. So it's a small piece of it, and it is included in the governor's budget.
And thank you for that. Is it included in the co-chairs?
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, I don't think that it is that $150,000. The co-chairs did add $4 million to this policy option package for the benefits going to providers. We were not clear, however, on that $150,000, what it was to be used for. And it sounds like it's a pretty critical piece of that package. But it was not included in the co-chair's budget. But we can have that conversation, of course.
Thank you. Could we get additional information on that part? Because it sounds like we have to move away from the legacy funding formulas, and we're going to put some money. We should probably make sure that's there.
Okay. Chair Carter, Representative Kotek will do a detailed explanation of what that will go purchase as part
thank
of that.
Thank you.
That
would
be helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick and making the information later. But could you give us, we talk a lot about what we're providing our providers, and there's a lot of discussion in this building in comparison with Blue Cross. Could you give us the difference between the rates, what we're paying per one sector and what we're paying on the other one, so that we have a clear understanding of the disparity between the two?
We can do that.
Thank you. Please, I'd like to remind everybody, tomorrow is public testimony. Please be on time so we won't keep people waiting. Thank you.